Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. Well, if you've listened to us for any length of time, you probably have picked up that we have a soft spot for explorers and exploration. And sometimes that extends to planetary exploration. We've done a number of shows on Mars, for example, and different aspects of the missions to Mars, some of which are in the news at times, and have had very interesting landing configurations, and then the little rovers running around on Mars have been just so productive. Our show today is about Mars. My guest is Dr. Kim Binstead, who's joining us actually from Hawaii today. It's a lot earlier out there than it is where I'm recording this show. Welcome, Dr. Binstead.
Hey, good to be here.
Can I call you Kim?
Yes, of course.
That's great. So she's an associate professor of computer science at the University of Hawaii, where she focuses her research on artificial intelligence and the human factors of space exploration. She's also a co-investigator at the NASA Astrobiology Institute, and now we're zeroing in on our show topic today. She's the principal investigator, which means research leader, of a project called High Seas, which stands for Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation. So that's one of those acronyms that I think you start with the acronym and work backwards anyway. So High Seas is an interesting experiment involving several people testing the limits of psychological endurance of conditions that simulate, more or less, in some ways at least, a mission to Mars. So, Kim, if you want to just start off by giving us an overview of the High Seas project.
Sure. Well, our habitat is on the volcano of Mauna Loa on the Big Island of Hawaii at about 8,000 feet in the middle of a lava field. And it's a small geodesic dome. It's about 1,000 square feet. And we put crews of six people in for many months at a time to look at their psychology and crew dynamics.
When did the experiment start? I mean, give us kind of the overview of where this experiment fits into other similar experiments of in preparation for a Mars mission in the future.
This whole category of experiment is an analog mission. So when I say analog, what I mean is that it's like a Mars mission in ways that are significant or interesting. And there's a lot of different analog sites and analog missions around the world. So the Russians recently finished the Mars 500 mission, which was 520 days in an isolation chamber. But the High Sea site is unique in that it's both isolated and easily accessible. So it's at this, when the crew look out the window, all they see are these barren lava fields. It looks very much like Mars. And yet we can keep them there for months, even if we wanted years on end, and study them, whereas that's harder to do at some of these other analog sites.
Yeah, so it's a bleak, lunar landscape-looking thing, I guess, but they are on Earth and they're in Hawaii. So how long is the mission for?
This current mission is 8 months.
And how long does a one-way trip to Mars take?
Well, it depends on the mission plan. The whole mission to Mars and back again would run 2.5 to 3 years. Getting there, depending, again, on the profile, on the order of 6 to 8 months. But what we're really looking at is the Mars exploration surface days. So after the crew have landed and they're exploring the surface of Mars. That's the piece we're looking at.
Okay, so you're kind of examining the psychological dynamics of a group of unrelated people who are professionals but who are still isolated for a long time in a very remote place. And I guess the thing I'm thinking is that if you're simulating the ground portion of the mission, you're not taking into account the long time, 6 to 8 months, as you say, that they've taken to get there. So they'd already be a little stressed and stretched thin by the time they get there, and it doesn't simulate the return part. So, it goes without saying that an actual Mars mission is going to be a lot harder on people than even this 8-month-long mission on the slopes of a volcano in Hawaii, right?
Absolutely. A real Mars mission would be longer. It would also be more stressful, obviously. It would be a lot more dangerous. But it would also be a lot more rewarding. A Mars crew would be the first people on Mars, and they would get that as a payoff. So, yeah, it's not a perfect analog by any means, but what we're working on as a philosophy is that if crew problems arise in our scenario, which is arguably easier than a real trip to Mars, then there's definitely something we're going to have to worry about on the real thing.
Okay. So, yeah, I understand that. You're basically trying to simulate the walk before the actual run and hoping that you can learn enough about the walk that it'll help you improve the run, maybe.
Huh? Yeah, exactly. That's the idea.
Well, let's talk about the conditions inside their geodesic dome there. So it's about the size of a large living room, I guess, and there are six people there, three men and three women. And what's, just kind of like, let's go down the list. What do they eat and drink? Are you trying to simulate the stuff they would have on in such a mission on the surface of Mars?
Yeah, their food is relatively realistic. So they only have shelf-stable items, so a lot of dry food, freeze-dried food, fewer canned foods. If we could find a dried substitute for a canned food, they have the dried version. They're able to grow a limited amount of food for themselves, but it really is just, it isn't a significant nutritional component to their diet, having a rabbit every now and then. But it's significant psychologically, both in that they get to grow the food and you'd be amazed at the value of a radish when you haven't had one for 8 months. but they manage to cook a pretty good meal for these dry foods. So, for example, they're able to make bread, they're able to make cheese and yogurt. They've got lots of herbs and spices. So, really, they've got a pretty good diet, although I think the texture ends up being a little lacking. The food ends up being a bit mushy.
Mm. Sounds like it compares maybe in the general realm of what the people on the space station, the astronauts in the space station eat. Maybe not as good.
It does, but actually our first mission was comparing different food systems. And the people in the space station, because they're in microgravity, it's very hard for them to do anything like cooking. The ingredients just don't stay in the bowl. So they have basically individual pre-prepared meals. Whereas what our crew have are the ingredients for meals, and they can combine them. So this there's advantages to both systems. One of the advantages to our current system is there's less packaging and therefore less mass. Also, bulk food items have longer shelf life. And also there's the combinatorial aspect. So when you have 10 different ingredients, you can combine them in hundreds of different ways to make all sorts of different meals. Whereas if you have a pre-prepared lasagna, it's a lasagna now and a lasagna forever it will be. So it's a slightly different system.
Okay, well, what about atmosphere and breathing systems? Obviously, they're on the surface of Earth, so breathing shouldn't be a problem. But are you trying to simulate a situation where it is a problem?
Well, no, we have, there's some things we just don't simulate. One is the habitat is not pressurized. Two, obviously, they're working under Earth gravity. Their spacesuits are simulated spacesuits in that they have the bulk and the weight and so on that you would expect from a Mars surface exploration spacesuit, but they're not actually life support systems. We also don't have radiation. We're not worrying about radiation. So there's some things we just can't simulate. Now, you did ask if we look at these at all. We do have simulated emergencies, and the emergencies are related to things like radiation and depressurization and issues like that. But those are just simulated.
How about sanitary facilities, including bathing? What do you do about that?
Well, as you know, water is a relatively limited resource. You either have to bring it or extract it from the environment. So we have them on a relatively limited water supply. So, for example, they have each crew member has 8 minutes of shower per week. Use however they like. They tend to break it up into 2 4-minute showers. It's a pretty common way of doing it. The toilets we have are composting toilets. They're commercial off-the-shelf composting toilets, but they're perhaps not dissimilar to what you might use. I mean, any system on Mars would be recycling the waste.
Does it get a little aromatic in there?
Actually, it gets a little aromatic outside. The toilets we're using have a very good fan system, and they vent the fumes, as it were, outside the habitat. So when we're working outside the habitat, we get a bit of a whiff, but inside it's not bad.
So you hope for a breeze. But what about
exactly.
What about sleeping arrangements? Again, they're not on in weightlessness, but on Mars they'd be in some degree of gravity. How are they sleeping? And does everybody have their own little bed or what?
Yeah, they actually do have a very small private space of their own. Essentially, the upper floor of the habitat is divided up into pie-shaped pieces, where each pie has room for a very small bed. We have one quite tall crew member, and he's not complained about it because he's not a complainer, but he fits in there with some difficulty. There's room for, and you can sort of sit on the bed, and there's a small, very, very small desk, and that's their private space. So they do have some, but that's about it. The rest of the hab is mostly open space that could be configured in different ways.
I hope part of your selection criteria is no one who snores.
It really should be, shouldn't it?
Yes, it should. Definitely.
Yeah, they do. They do have visual privacy, but they don't have much in the way of auditory privacy.
There you go.
Hear pretty much anything that happens in the hab.
Yeah, can't make earplugs good enough, huh? Well, what about, speaking of earplugs, what about communications? I mean, are they trying to simulate, there's a long communications time lag gap between Mars and Earth, and also you're not going to be, you know, chatting on the phone, on the cell phone all the time or whatever. So how restricted are, what are you doing about communications there?
We have imposed on them a 20-minute latency, so a 20-minute time lag, and that pretty much rules out all real-time communication. So you can't pick up the phone, you know, they can't surf the internet because each click would take 40 minutes. You know, your click goes out and the data comes back. Most of the communications are by email. And we also use a service called Basecamp, which is essentially a project organization service, and that's how they communicate with mission support. But again, it's essentially via email. They can't record videos and send them, and we can record videos and send them back. So for example, I'm right now uploading the end of the World Series for them. They're getting it 2 days late, what can I say?
Hmm.
So they do get videos, but they are not real time.
You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Kim Binstead, who's the principal investigator of a project, a NASA mission. It's going on the slopes of Mauna Loa, a volcano in Hawaii, and it's called High Seas, which stands for the Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation. And they're really investigating the psychology of people who are in a very small enclosed environment that simulates being on the surface of Mars for a future Mars mission. So, Kim, how were these six people chosen? Are they representative of likely astronauts?
We try to choose our crew to be as astronaut-like as possible. So we look for people with relevant educational backgrounds, relevant work experience, similar psychological profile. And then we also sent them a larger group on a NALS course. So NALS is the National Outdoor Leadership School, and NASA uses NALS courses for astronaut training as well. So we sent them on a NALS course and used their performance on the NALS course and how they worked with each other to down-select the crew that's currently in the habitat. But we end up with people who are very astronaut-like, perhaps a little younger than the astronaut corps, but generally speaking, pretty high fidelity, I'd say.
I would imagine, I mean, I remember, you know, for those who read or saw The Right Stuff and are aware of how rigorous the selection was for the original Mercury astronauts and for the Gemini astronauts after that, I mean, they were taking thousands of people and paring them down to seven or a handful, you know. So I would imagine for a Mars mission, you'd do the same, and that their psychological stability and compatibility is going to be a big factor. So, you know, I would think what you're doing here is an important kind of precursor to a Mars mission, because it's probably going to be an important selection factor in picking the people to go to Mars. But what are these people doing while they're there? I mean, are they simulating Mars mission tasks or playing chess or what?
Yeah, well, they're not bored. You know, our crews tend to go in with an ambition to learn to play an instrument or learn a language or whatever, and then they find that they're pretty busy, almost 24/7. In addition to the main research, the psychological research, which involves questionnaires and, you know, little exercises they need to do and so on, they're also, of course, maintaining the habitat, taking care of the equipment, cooking, exercising. They've also each got their own research project to carry out, so that's a big chunk of their day.
Hmm.
And they're also doing EVA, so they're going outside the habitat. We've given them a series of geological research tasks and also simulated emergencies, which end up taking up a lot of their time. They have very full days.
What's your role? Are you kind of the the den mother or something? Are you their interface? Are you their interface with the outside world or what?
Well, I'm the principal investigator on the project, as you said, so that's the research lead. I run the whole thing.
Yeah.
We have a bunch of different groups who are involved. So there's the research team who, you know, are pushing the buttons and, you know, running the studies. A big part of this is our mission support team. So this is a group of about 20 people all over the world who interact with the crew on a regular basis. So we have mission support there and ready to help them from 8 a.m. in the morning to 8 p.m. in the evening, just sort of hovering over their keyboard, waiting to help the crew. Mm. And then we also have sort of standby mission support 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in case of an emergency or a near emergency. So this is that they feel well supported. At times, of course, they feel like mission support isn't necessarily moving quickly enough or understands what they're going through, but we hope to give them as much support as we can.
How do you actually monitor? I mean, I guess, you know, the point of the experiment is to assess their psychological capability for handling this situation. So how do you monitor that or measure that?
Well, at a level, we're actually testing ways of monitoring their psychological state. So astronauts, as you can probably guess, are pretty stoic people. When you ask them, you know, how are you doing? They tend to say, great.
Mm-hmm, right.
How are you getting on with your crewmates? Very well. You know,
yeah.
It's a little hard to detect problems before they arrive on astronaut crews. So one of the things we're testing, or several of the things we're testing, are ways of detecting the state of the crew and the state of the individuals on the crew. So, for example, Michigan State University is one of our collaborators, and they have a badge which captures the distance between the crew members and also the volume of their voice. So if two people are standing face-to-face and shouting at each other, we might guess that there's a problem between them. Similarly, if a crew member has isolated themselves in their room and isn't interacting with anyone, then that might also be a problem as well. So this is a way we're basically testing this badge with our crew so that it might be deployed with astronauts.
But you don't listen in and have someone monitoring all of their interactions, you know, a psychologist listening and going, ooh, I could detect a little bit of strain between, you know, John and Jane there or something. You don't have that kind of monitoring.
Not sort of big brother monitoring, in part because, you know, astronauts realistically wouldn't tolerate it.
Hmm.
So, you know, what we're trying to do is we're trying to have passive systems which are minimally invasive that will still give us the information we need before they get serious.
Yeah, but I would think that with these people really not being astronauts as such and knowing that they're in an experiment that's psychological in nature, I would think at least after the mission is through that they would all write up a report and be pretty frank and objective about how they get along, because that's what the point is. And that's what you want to know. You know, so I would think, wouldn't you rely on them to do that?
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the reasons to do this study rather than just working with astronauts who are obviously higher fidelity. Is that this crew, they're not waiting on flight opportunities. You know, their careers aren't on the line if they admit a weakness.
Hmm.
So we can get better data from crews like this than we get from the real thing at some level.
We once had on American Variety the commander of an underwater space mission simulation called NEMO, which took place on a thing that was anchored on the sea floor off the Florida Keys. I guess you're probably familiar with that. Did it test similar things as far as long-term psychology?
Yeah, so NEMO is a wonderful analog, and as I mentioned earlier, different analogs have strengths and weaknesses, and one of the strengths of NEMO, of course, is that you can't just go outside. They do have to go outside as divers, and it's a different kind of environment than what we're working in. But one of the limitations of NEMO is that really they can only do up to, say, a couple of weeks long mission, and there are some problems that don't really arise until much later in the mission. So, for example, you don't really see the effects of serious effects of sleep deprivation until, say, 100 days or so. And also, it's if you've got a motivated crew, you know, they can fake getting along, they can fake not being stressed for a little while. But eventually, you know, you can only be so stoic for so long. So, we're really looking at some of these longer duration effects. But as I say, in some ways, NEMO is a much higher fidelity analog than ours.
You are listening to American Variety Radio, hopefully in high fidelity, and I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Dr. Kim Benstead, who's running an experiment called High Seas, that's taking place in Hawaii. It's part of a series of missions that will simulate a mission to Mars and life in a capsule-like habitat on the surface of Mars. Kim, is NASA actively planning a human Mars mission at this point? I mean, is there a schedule for it? Is there a target date? Is it on the board?
Well, they're looking out at for the 2030s as a potential time for a Mars mission. It's a little frustrating because, you know, Mars has been 20 years away for the past 40 years.
Right.
And it's still 20 years away. So that said, NASA does have a list of risks to retire before a Mars mission, and we're actively checking those off. We're trying to get rid of them in advance of a Mars mission. And the psychological risks are included in that list. So, as I say, there's this list of risks, and they're all rated either green, yellow, or red for a range of mission profiles. And any risk that's marked red basically needs to be solved before NASA will carry out that kind of mission.
And psychology is one of the red risks?
Psychology is one of the red risks, yeah.
What are some others, do you know?
Radiation. I mean, they're broken down into sort of sub-risks, and they're all spelled out in very bureaucratic style. But, yeah, radiation definitely is. The concerns about changes in the shape of the eye are still on that list. Looking at how to do a remote medicine is on that list. You know, say someone has a serious medical issue and needs to have an operation. How do you do that safely on this kind of mission?
Wow.
And something that we look at is also, of course, crew composition. How do you, given a pool of astronauts, how do you pick the crew that's going to do well over this sort of 2 to 3 year long mission?
So as I understand it, there are 3 planned high seas missions in this project, and this is the second one. So was the first one very similar, and was it the same group of people or a different group, and did you do the same thing? And then what, same question for the third one, will it be the same?
Right. Well, our very first mission, as I mentioned, was a food study, but in this set of 3 where we're looking at psychology, the first one was 4 months long, and that finished a few months ago. Also had a crew of 6, although one crew member had to withdraw for personal reasons. We've got the current crew, which is in for 8 months. And next year, we're going to do a crew for a year, 12 months long. The crews they're all 6 people, and we try to select them. We select them according to the same criteria. But of course, each crew has its own personality. It's one of the very interesting things. You can try to select crews as similar as possible. Once they start working together, they each develop their own culture, their own personality. So it's very interesting to see it develop.
Do you think it's possible that NASA will select a crew of real astronauts who are, you know, very highly selected and put them through an experiment like this as a test or a conditioner?
That's one of the things we're trying to encourage. Right now, that's not part of how they do things, but it does seem to me and to many of my colleagues that if once you've picked a crew for a mission of that length and that importance, it makes sense to test the crew in analog conditions. So if I were the boss and I were picking a Mars crew, I would, before sending them to Mars, I would send them to Antarctica for a few months and see how they do. Because if they can't handle time in Antarctica, they're not going to be able to handle the longer mission to Mars.
What did you find in the first experiment? Did people get along well throughout the whole thing, or were there some kind of psychological, not breakdowns, but I mean bumps in the road? What were your findings so far?
Our crews have been absolutely excellent. Now, of course, there's conflict. Any group of people is going to have issues at some point. So, for example, on the first crew, they speak in hushed tones about the Nutella incident. but they're very much like, I would say, a good family in the sense that, you know, they each have their ways of doing things. They work out how to get along with each other. They have conflicts, but they also have solid conflict resolution strategies. And they make them work, and they make the mission work. So far we've not had any critical crew breakdowns. We've just had normal conflict that's been well resolved and well handled.
Can you tell us just briefly what the Nutella incident was?
Essentially, it comes down to how you ration food. So we give the crew the food for their mission, and it's up to them to figure out how to divided up over the months of the mission. And essentially, there was a bit of a dispute about whether or not the Nutella was going to last. And it was a highly valued resource. So it was a debate of some importance, put it that way.
Well, so there's three men and three women, and you said they're all young. Are they all single?
This crew is there. Some have relationships, quote unquote, back on Earth. Some are single. You know, it's a bit of a mix.
We've
had married people on crew. You know, we've had people in long-term relationships. We've had pretty much every type.
Do you find, sometimes do you have the beginnings of relationships between male and female crew members developing?
So far, not. So far, our crews haven't had any within crew romantic relationships, but of course, there's always the potential for that.
Yeah, that would complicate things. But I would think with astronauts, that would not be in the picture, just by the nature of it, real astronauts.
You know, I disagree. You know, anytime you put a group of people together, whether mixed gender or same gender, for that kind of length of time, there's going to be, they're going to develop relationships of one kind or another, whether they're romantic or antagonistic or friendships. And it's that dynamic that we're interested in. There's no solution to human nature. All you can do is acknowledge it and be aware of it, and denial doesn't help either.
Mm-hmm. I guess the best thing you can do is just pick people who are very professional, very mature, very rational, very capable of controlling and handling their emotions and compartmentalizing things and, that sort of thing, right? Would you agree?
Well, exactly. You know, if you get a group of people who understand what they're getting into, understand themselves very well, they're self-aware and they're aware of other people, then things develop how they develop, and hopefully the crew will be able to handle them in a, professional and productive way, so that they don't disrupt the crew.
Well, again, briefly, we just have a minute or so left, Kim, but what do you think about the prospects for crew psychology, which is one of these red risks causing problems in a Mars mission? Is it likely to be a showstopper, or are there effective countermeasures that will prevent it from being a big problem?
If we do our job, it will not be a showstopper. What we're trying to do on these analog missions is we're trying to hash out these issues and give NASA the tools they need to select crews and then to support crews on these long-duration missions so that there aren't any psychological, there aren't any issues in the crew that would put anyone at risk.
That sounds good, and I'm glad you're doing it, and good luck with it.
Okay, thank you so much.
To learn more about the High Seas mission, you can go to highseas.org. And so that's HISEAS.org, highseas.org. And you can also go, if you want to keep up with life in the high seas bubble, right, you can go to, there are a couple of blogs, but one of them is by crew member Jocelyn Dunn. And her blog is at 5-star-view, spelled just like it sounds, 5starview.blogspot, blogspot.com. 5starview.blogspot.com. So you can, keep up with what amounts to a Facebook page of stuff about what's going on day by day there. Well, Dr. Kim Binstead, I want to thank you so much for being on with us in American Variety and talking about this interesting mission.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.